You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
My guest is Dan Greenberger, and he has written a lot for television and film, and he has a brand new novel written especially for people like me. That is, people who love the Beatles. Or I guess everyone loves the Beatles, but the more you know and love them, the more rewarding this hilarious new book is. It's called The Boys Next Door, a novel about the Beatles. Dan Greenberger, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, Gary.
You know, we've all wanted to be, everybody that loves the Beatles the way I do, have always wanted to be a fly on the wall and admire our heroes, especially, you know, before they were renowned all over the world. And I've been to Liverpool and to Hamburg too, to walk in the Beatles' footsteps. But your hero, what's his name? Alvy Singer. He doesn't even like them. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, it was, you know, my background, as you mentioned, is mostly writing comedy. So to me, you know, a lot of times the idea comes from, you know, what's the funny idea? And to me, the funny idea was, we've all had the experience of having a next door neighbor that drives us crazy with loud music at all hours of the night. And I thought, well, what if the next door neighbor was Mozart? Or in this case, what if it was the Beatles? And so that was kind of the starting point. And, you know, then it became just a question of, all right, well, if I'm going to, you know, tell this lie that, yes, I live next door to the Beatles in 1960, what do I need to do to make that believable? And that's where, you know, all the research comes in, all the, you know, the emotions, because you have to believe that this is a real person. And, you know, so it sort of went from being the joke to then being a lot more than that. But again, for me, that tends to be the starting point.
And it is a hilarious book, but it's also incredibly well-researched, because, you know, everything that happens, you know, the Beatles have been so well-documented by so many authors, and you can find almost every minute of their lives. So you're like you found a way to put your character into the story without changing the story.
Yeah, no, and it's really true. I mean, it's remarkable how well documented their lives are. And even that trip to Hamburg, which was in the fall of 1960. And actually, the other thing that sort of kicked the book off for me is that I had recently read a biography called Tune In by Mark Lewisohn. I think he's been a guest on your show, right?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Which is just, I mean, it's stunningly detailed. And I remember reading it and thinking, my God, you know, 1960, nobody knew who these guys were. They were an obscure bar band from Liverpool. And yet, you know, almost day by day, he was able to recreate what happened and to whom and this cast of characters. So in a way, you know, that was sort of delivered on a platter to me, and it kind of made my job a little easier, because yeah, I did just sort of build a plot between all these things that actually happened. And you know, because I'm a first-time novelist, that also kind of made it a little easier too. And I wanted to make it a little easy for myself, because I'm not a master novelist. I know the form pretty well. I read a lot of novels, but you know, it's my first time trying it, so I wanted to kind of stack the deck a little bit in my favor.
So in addition to, and I don't know if you know this or not, but you know, Tune In, the book you just mentioned by Mark Lewisohn, that is the American version of that book, is a mere, you know, 1100 and something pages. There's actually a British version of the book that's twice as long.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and I heard that he's working on another volume.
Oh, yeah, it's only volume one. That's right.
Yeah, because that first one ends, I think, in 1963, which is still before anyone in America had ever heard of them. And yeah, like 1,100 pages worth.
Yeah, it's crazy. But so in addition to that book, which is pretty well researched, did you do additional research as well?
Well, you know, I've been researching my whole life. You know, I'm one of those crazy Beatles fans where I really do know everything about everything. And in fact, that was how I kind of became interested in the Beatles in the first place. I grew up not knowing very much about them as a kid. You know, my parents were classical music fans, and I was a bit of a snob, much like the character who was kind of based on me in the book, you know, kind of looking down my nose at rock and roll. That's not sophisticated people. My goodness. And I think when I was in junior high school, somebody gave me a book, an early biography of the Beatles. I haven't come across it since then. And I just read it and thought, wow, this is really interesting story. And these guys sound kind of cool. And I started listening to their music at that point. And I've never stopped. I've never stopped listening or reading about them. And as you say, there is so much material out there. You could spend a lifetime reading it all, and a lot of people do.
Yeah, yes. I think they're probably, you know, Abraham Lincoln, Adolf Hitler, the Beatles. Let's, there's more stuff about the Beatles. And yet, the thing that's most interesting about the Beatles is that you, after 50 years of listening to them, I can still hear things. In fact, every time I listen, I hear things.
Yeah. Heard before. Oh yeah. No, I mean, they were incredible artists, and that is one of, yeah, that's, I don't think people become obsessed with artists if there isn't that depth of content and meaning there that you can just continually discover new things about them. And yeah, it's fantastic.
Astrid Kirchner, who just passed away, is one of the characters in your book, and it's kind of great to meet her and hang out with her.
oh, in the book, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I actually don't know if I told you this story, but yeah, she was, and again, this was sort of the idea, all right, going, you know, starting with the idea of the book, okay, they're driving him crazy, but then how does he actually get to know them? And I thought, again, you read about Astrid Kircher. She was this beautiful, genius photographer. And by all accounts, she was very, very charismatic and one of those women that everybody fell in love with. And so when I finished the book, I very much wanted to get her blessing on it. And I wanted to use one of her photographs for the cover. And I tried for the longest time to track her down, and it was hard. And I got hold of her people, and they said, "Yeah, we'll arrange a meeting." And then I didn't hear anything, and I should have known what was coming. And I finally found an address for her online, and I wrote her this long, heartfelt letter, which was a very strange experience to write this long, heartfelt letter to the main character in your novel. You know, somebody who I had been falling in love with myself over the course of, you know, a year or so. And I wrote her this letter. I sent it to her. I put, you know, postage on it. It was supposed to arrive in Germany on a Thursday, and she died on Wednesday.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was heartbroken. I really thought, you know, I've missed my chance. And it was really, really sad. But the happy ending, in a way, I mean, was that she sold all the rights to her photographs to a gallery owner about 10 years ago. And I contacted him shortly afterward, and I had a lovely conversation with him. He's a really great guy. And he was very supportive of the project. And he said, you know, this is exactly the sort of thing Astrid would have loved. And he gave me the rights to use the photos. And I ended up dedicating the book to her.
That's a bittersweet story for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love how you, I don't want to give away too much because there are so many wonderful laughs to be had. The more, as I was saying, the more you know about the Beatles, you know, the funnier it is. But just give us a taste. Tell us the story in the book where your main character is a poet, and he shows his poetry to John Lennon.
Right. Yeah, well, he's there And again, you know, again, why does he go to Germany? He goes to Germany because he's very into the German poets, like Rilke. And I knew somebody in college who was crazy, and it was like Rilke mania for them. And so he's written this poem called Locations. And at one point he shows it to John Lennon, and like everything that my main character does, it's pretty pretentious. And it's something like, you know, there are locations which will remain in my memory for the duration of my existence. And John Lennon says, well, why do you say it so complicated like that? Why don't you just simplify it? Say something like, there are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, you know, and he sort of rewrites the poem. And that's, again, the joke, you know, that, and then Alan ends up giving him the poem. So at some point, the idea is that John pulls it out and uses it.
And of course, that's only one example in which the story of the Beatles is furthered by actions by your character, Alan, who's, in fact, you're basically you, you're saying. Yeah. And so you're not only writing a novel about the Beatles, but taking full credit for their success.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, somebody's got to. Yeah, well, no, that is, and that is the fun of it, and I think for Beatles fans, because there's a lot of Easter eggs, and like you say, the more you know about the Beatles, the more you'll go, oh, I see what that turns into 15 years later. Oh, I see how that, and it's, it was a lot of fun to do that, and again, that's based on a lifetime of accumulating all these weird, you know, Beatle facts and Beatle mythologies, of which there are millions.
The thing that I loved about your book, and I loved many things about it, but one of the things that I love is that although it's set in 1960, you managed to satirize the entire run of the Beatles. So, I mean, there's satirical moments that harken to the very end of their career. So.
Yeah. Well, no, that was, and once I figured out that ending, and I don't want to give it away, but that's when it kind of clicked into place for me. It's like, how does the book end? And the book ends the same way the Beatles end. But I won't say anything more so that people will buy it and read it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking this week with Dan Greenberger. He's the author of a new novel called The Boys Next Door, a novel about the Beatles.
You've written a lot for television and movies. Anything that we know that you've written?
I moved to Los Angeles about 20 years ago, and I wrote for a couple of sitcoms. They were, the guy who sort of discovered me, I guess you would say, was Stephen Bochco, who did... Sure. You know, Hill Street Blues and
Pop Rock.
Pop Rock, yes. And it was actually during his Cop Rock period, he briefly got into comedy. And unfortunately, the comedies didn't last for long. So, you know, I wrote for one called Public Morals, which nobody's ever heard of. Another one called Total Security, which nobody's ever heard of.
So you wrote for the only Bochco failures in his long storied career.
Yeah, well, at least it wasn't as huge a failure as Pop Rock was. I mean, that's become sort of legendary as far as, you know, someone wants to say, yeah, a bomb show. Yeah, he did a Pop Rock on that one.
Well, what was he like? Did you get to know him well?
Yeah, no, he was a great guy. It was, you know, both of them were pretty brief runs, so I didn't get to know him all that well. And in fact, he both of those shows, he was really more of a consultant, and the guy running them, or at least in one case, was another sort of great TV guy named Jay Tarses. Yeah, and he did The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, I know.
Loved that show. That was a great show.
Yeah, and he wrote for Newhart. So, you know, it was a couple of really, really great guys. But unfortunately, they were both, or at least Tarses was kind of at the end of his career. Bochco, you know, this was just kind of a detour. And he soon got back into drama. And you really do, if you write for a TV show, you have to get a little bit lucky, because there's, you know, a 95-98% failure rate on them. So, you know, if you get on a show that lasts, good for you. And you'll do very nicely, but most of us don't. And then after that, I sort of got into other forms of TV writing. That
I saw Talk Soup on your...
Oh, yeah. Too. Right. It was a lot of fun. And what I do now, actually, is I'm a staff writer for CBS, and I write and produce the on-air promos for the comedies. So, you know, in the old days, when I was writing on a show and the show gets canceled, you're out of work for a year or two. And now when a show gets canceled, they say, okay, your show's canceled, here's your new one. And I'm, oh, I think I like this.
Well, that's great. Good job security.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and I've been at it for like almost 20 years. So it is a very, very secure little tiny area of the business.
And television is changing so rapidly and radically.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, CBS is kind of the dinosaur. And people have been telling everybody else that, you know, well, those days are numbered and, you know, that's not going to last. I always kind of liken it to like Broadway theater when talking pictures came along. You know, it's like, well, we're not going to be seeing any more live stage plays. I mean, who would go to one of those when you can just go to a movie theater? And yeah, it's not quite the big deal that it used to be, but it is held on and still thriving in its own way. So that's what I'm hoping will happen with CBS and, you know, traditional television.
It must be fascinating. I watch a lot of television.
Good. It's working.
So back to your book for a few minutes, The Boys Next Door, a novel of the Beatles, my guest, Dan Greenberger. Let's just talk a little bit about Pete Best. So in your story, Pete Best is kind of dim-witted. do you think that Pete Best was fired from the Beatles because he wasn't as funny as the rest of the Beatles were, or interesting?
I think so, and I feel a little guilty that I portray him that way. I mean, not least because he's still around.
You think he's read your book? Probably not.
Yeah. Pete, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it.
He does listen to my show, I'll tell you. Absolutely.
I know people who have met Pete Best, and they've said, and I tried to rely as much as I could on first person. Like, I know people who have met Paul McCartney, and they gave me some really good information. And same with Pete Best. They say, yeah, he's very low key, low energy. He was a good drummer, from what I hear. But what I've read about him is that, you know, the other three, John, Paul, and George, are very sharp-witted, fast-witted guys. And especially John. I mean, his mind was like lightning. And there was a feeling, and I've heard even McCartney say this, that Pete just, you know, he couldn't keep up with them on that level. You know, I also believe that Ringo really was a much better drummer. I mean, Ringo is one of the great drummers ever. And Pete was good. You know, you can hear him on a lot of the early recordings, and there's nothing wrong with his drumming, but Ringo took it to a new level, I think.
Well, of course, Ringo was only, Ringo and Pete Best were just two of the many people who drummed with the Beatles, including even after Ringo, there was briefly Jimmy Nichols, who replaced Ringo.
Right. Yeah, he'd make a good novel someday.
Apparently, his stint with the Beatles was not a great thing for him.
Oh, right.
Yeah, when they kind of flew away and left him in obscurity, it was hard on him.
Yeah, I remember seeing a photo of him like at the airport going back.
Yeah, waving goodbye.
Yeah, and he just looks very sad, and it's like nobody recognizes him. He went from being the most famous person on the planet to just another guy in the airport. And I just
four weeks as a Beatle, yeah.
Yeah.
I love the book. It's a fantastic book. It's called The Boys Next Door, a novel about the Beatles, and the author, my guest, Dan Greenberger. Dan, thanks so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a really good time.
That was Dan Greenberger, and his new book is The Boys Next Door, a novel of the Beatles. And speaking of the Beatles, October 9th is the 80th anniversary of the birth of John Lennon. John's first wife was Cynthia Powell Lennon, who died in 2015. In 2005, she wrote a biography of John Lennon and joined me here on From the Bookshelf to talk about the book, which is called John. I began our conversation by saying that the music of the Beatles was everywhere, even today, playing in grocery stores or elevators, and for Beatle fans like me, it was a source of joy. But I asked Cynthia Lennon what the constant presence of the Beatles' music was like for her.
Well, I know no difference. You know, it's been happening forever since I met John, more or less. I love the music like you do and like millions of other people do, and that's all that matters to me. You know, the music will go on forever.
Are there any particular songs that are special to you?
Well, yes, there are, and yes, of course there are. I mean, most of them are very special to me because I was there when they wrote them, when they recorded them, and when we heard them on the radio and in supermarkets and everything else. I mean, that is part of my life. It's my essence, you know, of being part of that situation. So there's nothing really... Well, In My Life is beautiful because it expresses so many things for so many people. And there are a lot of other songs, obviously, that relate to certain times in our lives together. And yes, it's all very reminiscent of the experience that I had.
Well, are there some you just can't bear to hear?
No, there were two, actually, and I think there was Love Me Do, which I didn't think was the best of what they had to offer in the beginning, but it made it. So my choice was not very good. But and there was also George's first sitar single, which I didn't quite like either, but then he progressed from that.
I remember, too, when that we first started hearing the sitar, I thought that was weird.
Well, it was a bit sort of miserable, you know? I mean, everything else was up market and upbeat and everything else, but that sort of brought you down, and it was very insightful and very thoughtful for George, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah. Well, your book is wonderful, and thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you.
It's somewhat shocking in the revelation of John as a less than perfect husband and father. You know, was it difficult for you to tell that story knowing how people revere John Lennon?
Well, you know, we all have to sort of come to terms with who we are and what we are and what makes us who we are. And having lived with John for 10 years, more or less, he's not a saint and he wasn't a sinner, but he was human. You know, when somebody is being revered, I didn't write the book to knock him in any way. I just wrote the book all the people that really loved him and care about him, just specifically to say to them, well, this was my experience, you know, and I was part of it, and I think I was entitled to write what I wrote.
Well, absolutely, it's your story, and it's very well written. How did you learn to write? Did you keep a journal in those years?
No, I love writing. I'm you know, basically I'm an artist. Well, I started out as an artist, and I became a support act, you know, to be obvious. But, I mean, that will never leave me. So I love writing and I love art, and I wrote the book longhand, because I'm not a computer buff.
No.
In any way. I mean, I'm beyond that. I'm too old for all that stuff. You know, they keep getting viruses. You know? I understand viruses, but not computer viruses. And fax machines are wonderful. So I wrote the book longhand, and I faxed it to the publishers, and they edited, and you know, came back to me and said, "Well, can't you say a little bit more about that or that or that?"
Yeah.
So it was a very interesting process.
How was it different from writing? How was writing John? You know, different from writing your previous book, A Twist of Leonard.
Oh, totally, absolutely. I mean, it's called the space that's in between, and so much time has gone by, so many experiences have been experienced by me, and I think, in fact, I was going to call it, "Will You Still Need Me? Will You Still Read Me When I'm 64?" Only I was 65, so I have to be honest, because everybody knows my age. there are so many things that happen to you when you're busy making other plans, right? That's what happened. I wrote Twist of Lennon, 78, mm-hmm. and long time since then. A lot of things have happened. A lot of water has come under the bridge, and I thought it was important to write it specifically to explain and express for myself and Julian and for John's family. Across the street, take my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Before you go to sleep.
Yeah, have you read any of the other 24,000 Beatle biographies that have been written? Did any of them get it right?
There's not enough time in the day, you know.
Yeah.
Life is very precious. If I spent my life reading, you know, all the millions of books that have been written about John by people who have never lived with him, probably had 5 minutes with him, or they want to do, you know, the date of this. And I mean, I had a lovely experience with a guy. He asked me when I got married, and I gave him the wrong date. He told me, "How could you possibly not remember the day you were married?" You see, that's when you're involved and when you're part of it, you don't even think about the dates and the days. Well, you know, if you're on the outside looking in, it's a different matter. But when you're inside, not having the chance to look out, that's another story.
So then, you're saying no, you haven't read any of them.
I've read a few. Read Albert Goldman's, only because Maureen, Ringo's first wife, gave it to me, and I read it about, it was about Elvis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that is so diabolical. And then he brought the one about John, and I thought, I don't believe that this man can get away with it.
Well, that was a bad one to read, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, you know, there's negative and positive in our world, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's somewhere in between. There's a balance somewhere, which we're all trying to find. And fine, we don't want goody-goody two-shoes, but we don't want...
Well, I suppose you could take anybody's life. I think you could take anybody's life and make it look horrible if you just...
Well, of course,
yeah.
Including yours, you know.
Not mine,
anybody's.
No. Not mine. I've never done anything wrong.
No.
I'm a very good
point. No, I haven't either.
No, not us. We're chatting with Cynthia Lennon, by the way, whose new book is a marvelous book, and it's called John, and it's a very intimate memoir of her married life with him and afterwards. Your Your book holds John's drug use responsible for the rift in your relationship, or at least partially.
Well, it's not necessarily just the drugs. It was a situation that grew from, you know, fame, fortune, realization. John went through a period, and in fact they all did, you know, when they had no private life, they had no space. And John's relief from that pressure was when he experienced, you know, drugs or LSD for the first time. So I'm not blaming everything on our breakdown of our marriage on drugs. It was a progressive thing that happened over a period of years. And fame, there are not many people who can survive that kind of pressure.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're listening back to my interview with Cynthia Lennon, first wife of John Lennon. A lot of books about the Beatles written after John Lennon's death lionized John Lennon and demonized Paul McCartney, and I asked Cynthia about the positive portrayal of Paul McCartney in her book.
Yeah, but why should people knock Paul? I mean, Paul is such a productive human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he's never stopped. You know, a hell of a lot of us would be very proud to be in his position at this time of his life. You know, he's produced music. He never stops producing it. He's a one-man show now, but he wasn't a one-man show then. You know, he was part of a team. It wasn't him that chose to break up the Beatles.
Yeah. Did he communicate with Paul at all? I mean, when was
last time? No. I've had a few conversations.
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, what we have as part of our history is what we remember. And I have fond memories of Paul. So I would never knock him. And he was the one that, you know, wrote Hey Jude or Hey Jules.
Right.
He was the only person that came to me when I needed somebody to sort of make me feel better. And that's how I remember. I mean, whatever anybody else feels or thinks, that's their problem, not mine.
You mentioned Maureen Cox a minute ago, and in your book, the Beatle wives, Maureen and Patty Boyd, and yourself, you sort of emerge as this group of friends who share this unique life experience. It was almost like the astronauts' wives, it seems.
The what?
No, the wives of the astronauts here.
Oh, right. Well, yes, I can understand that. Absolutely, because we were in a cocoon.
Yeah.
You know, and whoever is connected with anyone that's on a mission, whatever kind of mission they're on, you know, you have a support act, and the girls or the women with the boys, the Beatles or the astronauts or whatever, you know, are the support act.
Right. Well, and then you were sort of torn away from them. Did you, in later years, did you reconnect with Patty or Maureen or Jane Asher?
Well, Maureen was always my good friend. Everybody went off in their own direction after the divorce of John and I. I think I was the first to go, and then the snowball went down the hill.
Right. Well, John always led the way, eh?
Well, yes. Well, he could always hold a crowd in his hand, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, no, then, you don't know where they... I mean, I know Maureen has passed away, but...
Yeah, no. I mean, there's so many sacrifices. It's a funny way of putting it, but you know, there's so many people that I've loved and lost over that period, and because of the intensity of the whole thing, I think that's what happens. Or maybe it's under a microscope and people notice it more. I don't know, but I lost an awful lot of lovely people very young, you know, during that period.
Yeah, there were a lot of casualties from that era.
The word.
Yes.
Casualties.
You know how hard it is. Now, in your book and in the current Newsweek, I see, you said some things about Yoko Ono that obviously, you know, one wouldn't expect your book to be very flattering to Yoko. You say that you feel she still attempts to separate you, separate Julian from his father's legacy, from John Lennon. What do you
think? Well, I think, you know, actions speak louder than words, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, yes, and again, the pen is mightier than the sword. But when it comes to the reality of everything, yes. I mean, it's a situation that is almost, you know, cut down the center. You know, that was our lives, and nothing existed before Yoko and John. And that's not the truth.
And that's one of the motivations for writing your book?
Absolutely. I've done so much in my life to support my son and to support the memory that he had a father called John Lennon. You know, I've worked very hard on that, and it's hard to explain, but, you know, we haven't disappeared. We haven't been airbrushed out. We still exist, and we still feel, and we're still part and parcel of the whole Lennon-Beatle legend. So don't even think about dismissing, you know, people who exist.
Well, what do you think is up with Yoko? I mean, do you think she's an evil person, or what?
No, do you?
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to say, but...
No, you asked the question.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think so. Although, in your book, and I think also in the new book about the Beatles that Bob Spitz wrote, I see her in a different way than I saw her as a fan.
Listen, all I can say about anybody in this world that is prominent or is part and parcel of the media or whatever is you make up your own mind,
mm-hmm.
you know? And you get on with your own life the best way you can. And it doesn't matter whether she's good, bad, or indifferent. It doesn't matter. What you have to do in life is just to keep your head above water and, you know, love the people you love.
Yeah, well, that's good. All you need is love, that's what you're saying.
Thank you. Yes.
I don't want to know what's going on. I don't want to know what's right or wrong. I don't want to know whose bed you're in. I don't want to know just where you've been. Oh, baby. You were never really good for me. Just maybe. You're a stranger to reality. And baby, don't you know you haven't got a clue?
And a few years ago, Julian was here in Santa Cruz. He played a fantastic show, mm-hmm. a sold-out show as well. And so we all want to know how Julian's doing, and is he going to come back to music and come back and see us again soon?
As we speak, he's working in his studio with his guitarist. And yes, next year we should, fingers crossed, have an album out.
Well, the last album was a fabulous one.
What?
I think it was the best album of his career.
Smile.
Yes.
It was superb.
Really great.
I know. Then I would say that, wouldn't I?
Well, anyone who heard it would.
Well, it was exquisite. And I don't think it went as far as it should have done, but at least, you know, he's back in the studio and he's happy, he's writing music, and it's en route.
Tell us a little bit about his life. Does he have a family or other? I mean,
no, he has a fiance
uh-huh.
of 8 years, and her name's Lucy. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Isn't that funny?
Not LSD.
No.
But yes, he's a good, he's a very good person, and he's very positive, obviously he has to be a little bit sort of hurt about what happened in his life.
Yeah.
And hopefully that my writing this book has released a few of those heavy bags that he's been carrying.
Well, his foreword to your book is quite nice also.
I know, I know. I didn't ask him to do that.
Well,
I was really, I was in tears when I read it, actually.
It's very beautiful. Well, it's one thing to, you know, when you get older, to sort things out with your father.
Yeah, well, that's not possible, is it?
Right.
But at least he can sort things out with himself, you know?
Yes. Yeah, that's wonderful.
There are places I remember.
Talking to Cynthia Lennon, whose new book, John, is a fantastic memoir. And in addition to the bad times that you talk about in your book is filled with wonderful stories of the boy you fell in love with in Liverpool. And I wonder if you could maybe relate some of the happiest times share with us today.
Oh, for goodness sake. Well, I've been so privileged. I really have. I mean, I know at the end of the book I said, if I'd known what was ahead of me, I would have turned around and walked away. But I am so grateful. I had the most amazing experience in my life. I have the most wonderful son. You know, you don't need an apprenticeship, do you? I mean, my life was an apprenticeship to be who I am now. And I was lucky enough to be part of it. And John and I, during our pre-Beatle period, were very, very much in love and very, very not even looking towards the future, thank God. I mean, all I can say is that, you know, we should never look beyond the moment that we have.
Oh, I know. Affection for people and things that went before. I know I'll often stop and think about them.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.